This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. The president of the libertarian-leaning Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute, Chris Watts, recently put out a paper with Inside Indiana Business about a look at the new mayors in the state of Indiana. He starts out by talking about the fact that 50 new mayors will take office across the Hoosier State in January, ranging from cities like Aurora down on the Ohio River to Gary on the shores of Lake Michigan and lots of other communities in between. And then he says he'll start turning campaign promises into governing policies. Some are going to face some very difficult challenges and some very tight budgets and the like. And who best to talk about some of these budgets, taxing and spending flexibility, is a person that Chris Watts, the fellow that wrote this story, talks about, and we're going to have him on our program right now. And we've had him on before, of course, Purdue University economist Larry DeBoer. And Larry, thank you for joining us from West Lafayette this afternoon.
I'm happy to be with you, Chris.
Well, I know that you and I guess Chris Watts does mention it in more detail about a new formula that you and your colleagues there on campus have come up with, the Revenue Capacity Service Cost Index. And it sounds very very economist. To be honest,
thank you.
Well, you're quite welcome. But it takes a look at local revenue in particular, and tries to compute it for the costs of whatever cities and towns across Indiana have to pay for on one level or another, whether it happens to be by a community or by a countywide. Will you take a moment and tell us a little bit about how this index that you have created came about, and how Chris Watts, the Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute, who quotes you quite often in his article, got all involved in that?
Well, first of all, actually, I started with this a few years ago with our local Purdue Regional Center for Economic Development, and they had a grant, and so said, hey, let's take a look at, see if we can't come up with an index that just shows the fiscal environment, you might call it. And then Chris Watts at IFBI decided that he wanted to hear more, and so he sponsored an expansion of that study. So that's how he got involved. Mm-hmm. The index is an attempt to say, all right, you've got taxable resources out there that can be used to pay for local government. You know, there's property values, there's income for the income tax, there's money received from the state aid formula for schools based on per pupil, there's money received for road funding based on miles. And so you've got all these sources. Each community has got these sources of revenue. And then there's costs. And the costs depend on how many people are being served, how many of them live in urban areas where costs are higher, how many of them are school children, which are really, really expensive, how many miles of road do you have to maintain and that sort of thing. And is there some way to match up the resources you've got to pay for services to the demands or the costs that those services require? And so the index says, hey, how about if we say, let's take the average property tax rate for the whole state, the average income tax for the whole state, let's take the average school funding formula amounts per pupil and so forth, and say, hey, that is an index on the revenue side of how much could a community raise if they simply did what people do on average in Indiana. And then likewise, on the cost side, suppose we delivered the average level of services, or at least the average expense of services to the population, to the cities and towns, to the school kids, for road maintenance, took those average amounts of expenditures and said, all right, that's service cost at average rates. And then if you compare the two, what you say is, if you tax at average rates, can you raise enough revenue to deliver an average level of services? And if you've got a great big tax base, the answer is probably yes. If you've got a relatively small tax base, the answer is probably no. And likewise, if your service costs are high, you probably can't afford to provide the average service level at an average rate of tax. But if your service costs are lower, then maybe you can. And so basically ran this for every county in the state and tried to measure who's got the underlying capacity to deliver services and who doesn't.
I know that in the article that we've been talking about, and I'm sure what you and your colleagues have discovered when getting all the data together, and you mentioned just a moment ago about the difference, of course, and we all know, between suburban areas and rural areas. Give us an idea, if you will, what kind of issues in particular that each different group, the suburbs and the cities and towns, if you can include them in as part of being suburbs, as well as the rural areas, which we just consider are some of the smaller communities out there that are in between all the others.
Yeah. Well, let's start with rural. You know, you might think that rural costs would be low and maybe rural revenues would be low, but I was surprised to see that sometimes the opposite is true. For rural costs, if you think about, you know, yes, there are fewer people. Yes, there are fewer folks in cities and towns, and those should keep costs low. But if you think about roads, even if there were no people whatsoever in the rural county, you'd still have to build roads. And so the amount of roads per person, the road expense per person in a rural area tends to be pretty high compared to an urban area. And it may not have very many roads, but even if there aren't any people, you still got to pay for them. So the road thing sort of raised costs a little bit more than one might have expected. But there's a kind of floor on the, especially the property tax base in rural areas, and that's farmland. The way we assess farmland in Indiana is not based on the actual selling price of the land. It's based on how much income it generates from raising corn and beans. And so you can imagine, again, suppose that the county emptied out of people. There would be no houses, there'd be no industry, there'd be nothing like that to tax, but the farmland would still be there, and it would still be a tax base. And so for rural areas, that puts a floor under revenue. And so an awful lot of rural areas, including Newton and Jasper, just south of you, have actually got quite positive capacity cost indexes. The amount of property tax revenue that can be raised actually exceeds the average cost of the services that can be provided, or the service, the cost that what the cost would be if the average level of services would be provided. Urban areas, on the other hand, have the higher cost. Suburban areas in particular have lots of school kids per capita, a very high percentage of the population of school kids. And school kids are the most expensive constituents in the whole state when you think about it. And the you know, the revenue side kind of depends on who you are. The donut counties around Indianapolis, for example, or Porter County near you, tend to have high-valued homes, a lot of commercial property, and so they've got and relatively high incomes, and so they've got quite the tax base to tax. But then there's a whole bunch of counties. Lake is one of those, but then a whole stripe of counties from Kokomo down to Connersville, from Cass County and Howard County down to Wayne and Richmond and Fayette, where industry has faded, maybe we can say it that way, and that great big tax base that you used to have, all those factories that you used to have, simply don't generate the tax revenue that they used to. But the people are still there to serve. Industry moves out faster than people do, I think, is the moral of that story. And so there's this, what you might call the old industrial counties, show up as pretty negative. You know, it's very hard for them to deliver an average level of services with an average tax rate.
And I know that it's very difficult to for many people to think when we're here in Northwest Indiana in such a populous area that there are such regions like that. So go south of Indianapolis, you find many more of them, with the exception of cities like Bloomington and Evansville and even New Albany and the counties down there across the river from Louisville. It's just hard probably for some people to unless they've lived down there or they have family or acquaintances down there, for them to realize what it's really like to see communities. You mentioned about about in eastern Indiana in particular. It doesn't take much to Google Connersville, Indiana, and see all the problems. And some of the problems have cropped up in recent years. But they had some big industry that used to supply the auto industry. But those plants closed up, and you've had an entire community or an entire county that's pretty much in trouble. And because of the loss of industry in that just one particular area. And there are many more like that across the state, I know.
That's right. You know, as part of the study, I took a look at manufacturing employment back in 1972. And back then, there were, at least a dozen counties where more than 40% of the employees in the county were in manufacturing, 40%, and Lake was one of those. And now, when you look at it, the most recent data, Lake is less than 10%. Delaware is less than 10%. And the only one left with more than 40% of the population in manufacturing, of the employees in manufacturing, is Elkhart County with the recreational vehicle industry. So this has been a tremendous decline in manufacturing. Now, you know, it's mostly, in fact, productivity and technology advancing, but some of it is also rearranging where manufacturing is done in the world through trade. But that tax base is just not what it was. And the thing is, though, originally people moved in for those jobs. And when the jobs leave, sure, the population does decline, but not as rapidly as the tax base goes down. And I think that's one of the reasons why we see those old industrial areas with the negative capacity cost indexes.
I know that many new mayors got into office by campaigning for change, something that they felt they could do if they're elected mayor that their predecessors couldn't do. And we know that many of these communities have to deal with some type of tax reform. How do you and your colleagues deal, at least with trying to assess what all has to be done by these new mayors as they take office in 2020?
Well, economic development is the problem, isn't it? Mm-hmm. What do we do in Indiana to replace the manufacturing tax base and the manufacturing employment? And that's what we're grappling with, and I don't think we've come up with an answer to that yet. There's some good practice on economic development, and especially in our current fiscal environment, you got to take care with the abatements and the tax increment finance districts and all those things that subtract from tax base in order to try to generate more tax base. I'm not going to sit here and tell you I know the answer there. But you put your finger on the toughest part of the job, I think. And under our current fiscal system, the way that you generate additional revenue is through growth. Tax increases are especially on the property tax side, hard to generate additional revenue in that way. It's growth in the value of property and in income where the additional revenue to provide services comes from.
Now, in your assessment, how do you think that the mayor should count on any, if it can get any, from help from the General Assembly? When the lawmakers come back into session in January, they're not dealing with any budgetary matters of their own, that is to say state government, but I'm sure that they're going to be hit up by a lot of lobbyists who are going to ask to help communities that need help get the help they need.
Well, you never know what they'll come up with. I don't think we'll see any statewide aid packages or anything like that, but perhaps the cities and towns folks and the county folks go and ask for some local flexibility might be a thing. And that has happened recently. The local income tax, for example, was made more flexible a couple of years ago. And, of course, we did have the change in the road aid formula that increased pretty substantially the amount of revenue coming back to the counties and the cities and towns for road construction, road maintenance. So things can happen. I'm not quite sure what the counties and cities and towns have on their agendas, but I know they'll be in there looking for flexibility and options, I think, is the kind of thing that they're hoping to get.
Do you think that maybe some of the flexibility and the options that you've mentioned here might come in, although it may be difficult for some to try to fathom what it would be like, for regional governments? We know that there are RDAs that have been established, certainly here in Northwest Indiana, but there are others that have been established around the state.
You know, this is, we looked at that actually with the study, sort of added up the RDAs and calculated capacity cost indexes just for the RDAs. And, you know, a lot of times you can sort of even out the cost capacity index if you've got some counties in the RDA that are positive and others that are negative. You can sort of even it out and match the capacity with the cost. And in a sense, that's what an RDA is for, or one of the things it can achieve. That, you know, doing that kind of depends on persuading the public, or the public coming to believe that we're all in this together. You know, if you're going to combine a negative county, a county that doesn't have the tax base to deliver services, with a county that does have the tax base, you know, that's going to be a shift in resources from the county in better shape to the county that's not in good shape. And is that something that the public is willing to accept, and the taxpayers are willing to accept? And if so, then the RDAs might be a solution to this thing. Of course, if you draw an RDA around that old industrial corridor in east north central Indiana, you still get negative numbers because all of the counties are disadvantaged. So that can't be the solution all the time.
Well, do you think that aside from politics, which we'll all be watching very closely in 2020, that that we'll see some changes that might be to some benefit for some folks in Indiana in the year ahead?
Well, I tell you, Chris, people ask me to predict legislation, mm-hmm. and I gave it up.
And probably wisely so, right?
I'm not any good at it, yeah. To tell you the truth. So I'll be watching just like everybody else to see what issues pop up and to see if the legislature is willing to deal and what kind of things they're coming up with.
Well, thank you for spending time to tell us a little bit more about the research that you and your colleagues there at Purdue University in West Lafayette are doing on dealing with the issues of finances in Hoosier cities and towns across the years in the past, and taking a look and maybe get some kind of assessment as what these new mayors are going to have their hands full with for the 2020. And we appreciate you spending some time to talk about it today.
Well, thanks for the chance, Chris.
Larry DeBoer is an economist at Purdue University based on the West Lafayette campus, and you're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. It's time once again for Building Northwest Indiana, and here's your host, Kevin Comerford.
Welcome to another edition of Building Northwest Indiana Radio. My name is Kevin Comerford. I am the Director of Professional Development at the Construction Advancement Foundation of Northwest Indiana, and I will be your host today. The purpose of Building Northwest Indiana Radio is to give you a little insight into the Northwest Indiana professional construction industry. Today we'll be talking about the Port of Indiana, which is located at U.S. Highway 12 in Indiana 249 in Portage, Indiana. My guest today is Ian Hurt. Ian is the Port Director for the Ports of Indiana Burns Harbor. Ian, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure to be here, Kevin. Thank you for having me.
So, many of our listeners probably don't even realize there's a port in Northwest Indiana. This port is a major inland port that's right on the southern edge of Lake Michigan and provides business with access to both national and global economies. Can you explain to our listeners a little bit about your operations at the Port of Indiana, Burns Harbor?
Sure, Kevin. We are a quasi-governmental agency, so we are part of the state of Indiana, but we run our own operations. So we have our own revenues, we pay our own bills, we kind of stand alone from the state in that regard. Currently, for the last 15 years, we haven't taken any money from the state of Indiana budget, so we just run ourselves. And what we want to do is we want to open up Indiana's economy to the world. So we can handle ships that can trade throughout the world. We can handle barges that can go down the Mississippi River and, again, have access to all the world's markets. So if it behooves people to bring cargoes in from around the world to Indiana, we're there to facilitate that. And likewise for Indiana exports, we wanted to be their conduit to get their goods out to the marketplace throughout the world.
And speaking of cargoes, what are the main types of cargoes that flow in and out of the Port of Indiana, Burns Harbor?
So we're very much a regional port, so we want to handle the things that are important to Northwest Indiana. So what we handle on agriculture products is a big thing. So it's the fertilizer that comes in, that goes out to the Indiana farms. And then the grain that is grown there comes back to the port and then goes out to the world's marketplace. Also, Northwest Indiana, obviously a big steel region, so we handle a lot of the raw commodities that make steel. as well as steel products that are being finished at the port by some of our port tenants.
I thought I saw an economic impact analysis that outlined the impact that the Port of Indiana, Burns Harbor, has on the local economy. Do you happen to know, like, dollar amount in terms of the value of cargo that's shipped through the port every year, or maybe weight and tonnage?
Yeah, so weight and tonnage is easy. Last year we did about 2.7 million tons of cargo through the port. Economic value is in the billions of dollars. The port itself generates about $4 billion annually in economic activity throughout the state of Indiana. And waterways cargo that comes in to northern Indiana, we only have 45 miles of coastline, but it generates about $13 billion in economic activity every year throughout the state.
Wow, that's pretty substantial. And then it's also an intermodal, too. You don't only just have shipping going in the port. You have other modes of transportation, such as rail and trucking. Can you talk a little bit about your intermodal network and how it all works together so you could get the products to your customers?
Yeah, so water is only one half of the transportation chain. So unless the facility is located immediately on the waterway, then if it's an inbound cargo, it then needs to end up at the final destination. So if it's going to Merivale or to LaPorte or someplace like that, it'll come in by water to the port. There are port stevedores, who are the companies that load and unload ships and barges. They'll unload it, and then they'll put it onto a train or they'll put it onto a truck, and then that'll complete the transportation chain when it gets to that final receiver in those cities that I mentioned, or cities throughout the Midwest for that matter, not just northern Indiana.
All right. And then now I recently read in the paper, I think it was back in August, that Burns Harbor announced a $20 million major expansion project that is expected to boost your cargo handling capacity. Can you talk a little bit about that construction project?
Sure. There are five big projects that we're going to have going on over the next 3 or 4 years. We started the first one this year, and what we're doing is we're improving those rail connections. So those are our first two projects. We're going to be putting in rail storage yards and tracks that lead to them, about a total of 14,000 feet of track, so around 3 miles of track will be put in. And again, what that does is it makes our port tenants and companies that want to use the port that much more competitive, because now we'll be able to bring longer trains into the port and bring in cargoes from further away economically and make the port more competitive. And that's what we want to do for the state of Indiana, is we want to drive cargoes through the port, because for every ton of cargo that goes through the port, the state of Indiana receives some money for each ton.
Has the construction project started?
They have. So we started about a month or two ago. Grimmer Construction's handling the first one for us. And we just let some contracts to Dyer Construction. Over the next year or so, they're going to be putting in that railroad track I mentioned. And the other projects that we have going on, we're going to be putting in a new berth for unloading bulk materials. So bulk materials are things like iron ore and coal and limestone, things like that, that move in big volumes. This new berth will make those more competitive, the way that we handle them. And we're also going to be adding about 1,500 feet of berthing space so we can put in another two ships and put in the cargoes that those two ships can carry into the port. So five projects in total.
Okay. So how much room do you have out there at the port? Is there room to expand and grow and add more capacity, or are you operating pretty much near capacity right now?
So the port itself is about 600 acres, and we have over 300 acres leased out to port tenants, about 25 different companies out at the port. But then we have another 150 acres or so that gets used up by railroad tracks and roads and docks and things like that. So we have a little over 100 acres that's still available to rent out to companies that might be interested in using the waterway to move their cargo. And the dock facilities, there's definitely room. We've got plenty of room to bring in more cargo. So if you need to move cargo by water, we're the place to do it.
So where can our listeners go to find out more information about the ports of Indiana and the ports of Burns Harbor?
So certainly we have our website at www.portsofindiana.com. And you can always give our office a call. We'd be glad to hear from you. We'd like to give tours, like to show people what's going on out there. It's a restricted area, so if you're ever driving up that way, you'll notice it's hard to get in. But we'd be glad to give tours if it's something of interest to you.
Yeah, I've made that mistake one time. Accidentally entered the port, I felt like I was being interrogated.
Yeah, unfortunately, since September 11th, we've had to tighten up the security restrictions a bit. So.
Well, that'll do it for today's edition of Building Northwest Indiana. I would like to thank our guest, Ian Hurt, who is Port Director, Ports of Indiana, Burns Harbor. To find out more information about the Port of Indiana, please visit portsofindiana.com/Burns Harbor.
Support for Building Northwest Indiana comes from the Construction Advancement Foundation, and you can hear Building Northwest Indiana on Tuesdays right here on Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, and the podcasts are available online at lakeshorepublicradio.org. This next story comes to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversation to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
Maryville, back, I guess, in the 1800s, was called Wiggins Point. Its claim to fame was that part of the old Sauk Trail went through Maryville. In fact, there's still a marker that indicates that location. Maryville wasn't very big then. There were other areas that are Maryville today that were known by a different name. That's why, for a while, all of the Maryville Fire Department fire trucks were different. One station, their trucks were painted red. One station, their trucks were painted white. The other one was painted orange. It was like everybody was separate, but one. It took a while before everything was combined together. Pre-incorporation, I can remember coming into Maryville with my parents so they can go to the farm stands. All that area, even going across 30, was nothing but a two-lane, bumpy road with farms on each side. There was a place called Kittyland. You know, to come from 8th and Adams to 61st and Broadway, where this was located, you thought it was like an all-day excursion. But I-65 changed all that. A great deal of credit has to go to Dean White with all of the development that he put at Route 30 and I-65. I think what he did there had a lot to do with spurring the mall to decide to build where they were at. If Dean White had decided to locate his businesses, let's say a little further south on I-65, we would have a different Maryville today. Maryville was incorporated for racial reasons. They did not want to be annexed by the city of Gary, and that was their biggest fear, I believe. You know, they had a bank account that didn't amount to but a couple, $3,000 in their treasury, but they made a substantial push to incorporate the town of Maryville. And they were able to successfully get that approved with legislation in Indianapolis, because the way the law read, in order for a community to incorporate that was adjacent to a city, and that city being Gary, they would pretty much have to get permission from that city. Gary wasn't about to do that because that was land that I'm sure at some point they wanted to bring into their territory. So they had to get special legislation. And technically any type of special legislation is supposed to be illegal, but it's done downstate every year on a lot of different issues. I do know that Chet Dobus had a lot of clout back then. And you didn't have no Republican supermajorities or anything like that. They had no problem in going along with what he wanted. You know, it was a national trend back then for people to leave urban areas and move to the suburbs. And then, of course, you had some pretty good salesmen that were selling these properties in Maryville at good rates and good prices, and people were just moving to the suburbs. I'll be honest with you, most of the subdivisions were white, but I do remember my family didn't move out of Gary until 1976, so we were kind of one of the last few families to move south. And I remember at that time, the Crescent Lake subdivision, which was just west of where I live, had already had at least one black family in it. So yeah, there was a transition, but it was very light at first, and then eventually, as the city itself changed in Gary, there were more black residents that wanted to move into Maryville.
You can find more regional stories online at welcomeproject.valpo.edu. A sea of teachers and public education supporters floated around the statehouse earlier this month. They were there to put pressure on lawmakers and demand better pay, school funding, and more respect for their field. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jeannie Lindsay reports on advocacy efforts that focused on public school issues have been boiling over this past year, and they've made the stakes even higher going into 2020.
It's a Tuesday morning just before 7 o'clock. It's still dark outside, and I'm getting on a school bus with a group of more than 20 teachers from Bedford, just south of Bloomington. We're going to the State House. Anna Wall is sitting toward the front of the bus in a thick red hat. She's an elementary school special education teacher, and she's talking with some of the other teachers about different shades of red they have on and what today means for them.
This isn't something I go to. I don't go to state rallies. I mean, I'd rather be in the classroom.
Wall says she doesn't follow policy, really, but she's seen changes in the classroom. And she's joining some 15,000 fellow educators as they call on lawmakers for things like better pay and equitable funding for schools. They also want fewer tests to evaluate kids, schools, and teachers.
And I think I want to say that, yes, I do stand for something. I stand for a teacher. I stand for all my colleagues that we are working hard.
Fast forward to later that morning. The sun is up and a wave of red-clad public school educators and supporters fill the State House and the lawns outside, carrying signs and chanting different messages of frustration, hope, and power. They even have a marching band blasting music fitting for a pep rally. It's the same day lawmakers return for the ceremonial start to the legislative session. The rallies echo through the building and outside for most of the day, reflecting a national movement called Red for Ed. Many say contentious policy changes and underfunding of public schools over the past decade led us here. And as State Superintendent Jennifer McCormick speaks to a crowd of reporters outside of her office, a few dozen teachers already inside the State House gather to listen.
We are not asking for the moon, nor are the teachers who are here. We are here asking for the basic foundations that makes an education system great and in turn makes a state great.
One of those foundations is funding. House Education Committee Chair Bob Boehning met with a group of teachers earlier in the day. He says right now, money matters are a tough ask.
This is not a budget year, so historically we have not opened the state budget.
He says lawmakers are ready to listen as they rework school measures of accountability and consider a second look at a new and controversial licensing requirement they approved last session. Many educators say they feel disrespected and unheard by lawmakers in the State House, too. Boehning says he thinks more, clearer communication could help ease that tension.
I will say that there's a lot of blame that we need to be accepting as well, that we need to be more open to having dialogue. And I'm not opposed to talking to teachers about where I am, where they are, and let's see if we can come together.
Teachers are already coming together in a way. Superintendent McCormick has encouraged educators to wield their voting power and has been increasingly vocal about their concerns heading into her final year as the state's chief of schools.
Our students deserve every bit of this advocacy that you see, but it is a shame that it takes this type of advocacy to get what our students deserve.
Educators hope to carry that kind of energy into the 2020 elections. It's hard to say how different legislative races could play out with a freshly fired up base of teachers, but next year's race for governor is a big one. The winner will choose McCormick's successor, appointing the state's chief of schools for the first time. And teachers like special educator Anna Wall hope someone will champion their needs in the State House.
I want respect. I want, you know, all the years of education that I do and all the training that I do on my own naturally, that it counts for something.
And to get it, the crowd made it clear. They're ready to take their frustrations to the ballot box next November. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jeannie Lindsay.
Indiana's unemployment rate remained at a nearly two-decade low in October, 3.2%. But Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports that the state has lost jobs through 10 months of the year.
Indiana hit 3.2% unemployment in September, then remained there in October. That's the lowest rate since December of 2000, and it's now been 7 months since the unemployment rate got worse. But the Hoosier State has lost about 5,200 total jobs this year. If that trend continues through the end of 2019, it would be the first time in 7 years Indiana lost jobs overall in a calendar year. Still, there are positive signs. Indiana's labor force grew last month, just barely by a little less than 600 people, for the first time since April. The labor force measures not just those who have a job, but also those actively looking for one, and so growth in the labor force is often seen as a sign of optimism in the economy. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
More than one half of Hoosiers get health insurance from their employer, and that coverage is growing more expensive. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan reports about a new Now analysis that looks into this trend.
The report from the Commonwealth Fund looks at all states and finds Indiana is in line with a nationwide increase in costs. From 2008 to 2018, the annual Hoosier employee contribution rose from 3.8% of a person's income to 5.7%. Sarah Collins, a VP with the Commonwealth Fund, led the study.
Even though premium costs take up a large share of people's incomes, many people are not getting insurance that offers them good cost protection. This is because, for many, deductibles are also high.
Add in an average $1,800 deductible for employees, and people in Indiana pay 10% of their median income out of pocket. Collins says research shows that high deductibles may discourage people with modest incomes from getting needed services. The report is part of the group's ongoing study into factors that drive high health care costs. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jill Sheridan.
Literally tons of turkey, chicken, eggs, and duck will go to Hoosier food banks in the annual donation from the state's poultry industry. Indiana State Poultry Association President Paul Brennan.
We got enough for 900,000 eggs. And then over 150,000 pounds of meat products, chicken, turkey, duck, and potentially processed eggs and so forth.
Gleaners Food Bank President John Elliott says eggs and dairy are particularly hard to come by for people who struggle to put food on the table.
It's as simple as people don't donate it as much. That's why a donation like today is particularly important, because we're still at a point where protein and dairy are very rarely donated.
Poultry producers actually make their donations throughout the year, but since 1948, they've been celebrating the year's donations at a pre-Thanksgiving ceremony at the State House. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. From time to time, we'll bring you some segments from Michael Puente's Friday Off-Mic program that's aired here on Lakeshore Public Radio. Today, we're going to revisit some of his conversations about the growing Democratic Party race for U.S. Congressman here in Northwest Indiana.
Welcome back to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Michael Puente. When Peter J. Visklosky announced 2 weeks ago that he would not be seeking another term to represent Northwest Indiana in Congress, it set off a mad scramble of possible candidates. Hammond Mayor Tom McDermott Jr. wasted no time in saying he's in. He was followed by North Township Trustee Frank J. Marvan. I caught up with Trustee Marvan in Indianapolis this week, and this is what he had to say.
My name's Frank Mervan. I'm the North Township Trustee, and why I want to run for Congress is simple, is that I have put families first over the last 15 years. And in the communities of Whiting, Hammond, East Chicago, Highland, and Munster, I have been able to do a large swath of things that have made an impact in the community. Disaster relief, transportation with Dial-A-Ride. I have been able to touch the senior citizens and make sure that they are taken care of and have a quality of place. And more importantly, what we need to know is that legislation impacts people. So we're in Indianapolis right now, and what we're talking about is education and public education. And thousands, tens of thousands of teachers are here talking about how legislation impacts people. And so I have seen, with union members being laid off coming to my office, how reckless conversations in Washington impacts trade. And so I'm on the ground zero of that kind of economic impact. So I want to create an inclusive economic theory for our communities, and I want to make sure that we're building jobs and that we're continuing our infrastructure of steel and going beyond steel, looking at automation and other things that can thrive our community.
What do you think about all the candidates that are supposedly jumping in this race? Is it going to be hard for you to get your message out?
No, it's not going to be hard for me to get my message out. If there's one candidate or if there's 50 candidates, my message is going to be the same. I've put families first, and I'm going to build an inclusive economy that allows all of us to work, allows all of us to educate ourselves to work, and has a strong quality of place. And I hope to carry the traditions of Congressman Vislowski. So the number of candidates makes everything more competitive, and it makes you sharper. And what that goes back to is your reputation and what you have done in the past. And I believe I'm head and shoulders above the competition is what I've accomplished and who I've been able to reach.
And just yesterday, another big name announced she's in. Mara Candelaria Reardon is a longtime Democratic state rep from Munster. She says she's running. I asked her yesterday, why does she want to run for this seat?
Because I think that it is, as my legislative career has been, I think it's another extension of being able to be impactful in the community and being able to bring, you know, protect health care and bring jobs to the community that we need. It's a way to move our community forward, and I've been able to do that at the state level, and I'm interested in doing that.
Why do you feel you're ready now for the job?
I've been in the legislature for over a decade. I've worked both sides of the aisle. I know what it is to be a legislator. I wouldn't presume to tell other people how to do their job. And so I think that for me, it's a natural transition.
And if you get into Congress, what do you hope to accomplish?
The same thing that I've been able to accomplish as a state representative is to move my community forward through economic development, good paying jobs. Those are the things that our community needs, protecting their health care.
With so many people's names have already sort of thrown their hat into the ring for this race, how are you going to separate your voice from the others?
Well, I think that my record speaks for itself. I certainly hope to point out that I'm the one with the most legislative experience in this race. I'm certainly qualified and able and have a great legislative record to run on. And I think that distinguishes me.
And we should mention that Porter County Attorney Jim Harper has also announced his intention to run for that congressional seat. Jim Harper ran as a Democratic nominee for Indiana Secretary of State in 2018. And, of course, a few others have been rumored to want to join the race. And joining me in studio to discuss the chances of these candidates is longtime Post-Tribune reporter Michael Gonzalez. Hey, Mike.
Good morning.
So what is, you know, we just heard from Mara Candelaria Reardon and earlier Frank Mervan. Tom McDermott is still out there, and we're still hearing a few more possible big names perhaps joining the race. This is going to be a tough fight. What do you make of all this?
Well, I think it's an exciting time. I think it's an exciting race. I think Mara's entry definitely adds some energy because of her experience. Because she'll actually be making, just by running, I think she's making history to be the first, she might be the first Latina to run for Congress from the state of Indiana. And that's what I'm thinking now. I have to double check that. But I think that adds a whole different element. And I think we have some wild cards out there.
You know, as we get, as we move along the going to May, what do you see as some of the bigger key issues that are going to separate the candidates?
That's a really good question, because right now they're going to say what campaigners say, family first, education, experience, et cetera. But I think you have to look at their records, and I think that'll become a little bit clearer come January and February. We'll have a better idea of the messaging. Right now, I think the nation is distracted by impeachment talk and some other stuff. But when we get down to actual matters, issues that really matter, after the holidays, we'll start to see this pan out and see where these candidates stand on the and what their key issues are.
You know, so many candidates, when they first run for Congress, I know Tom McDermott Jr. has mentioned this, that, you know, he sees sort of a logjam in Congress, that even the Democrats, they're so focused on impeachment and challenging the president, they're not really doing the work that they were sent to Congress to do, that he's going to work in a bipartisan fashion. You know, in covering politics and kind of seeing how Congress works, anybody who gets in there, they're probably going to have to toe the Democratic line once they're in. They may have other plans to sort of work in a bipartisan fashion, but right now Congress is not working that way.
And I think it's going to be very tenuous for anybody who wins for the first couple of terms. It does really take a while to establish a name, to establish a record, and to give the voters a reason to feel more comfortable. And that includes what kind of federal funds are you bringing back to Northwest Indiana? Because I think that's something that Pete Visclosky, after the first couple of terms, really excelled in, was bringing home projects and money to Northwest Indiana.
Well, who of those candidates? Right now it's Amara Candelaria Reardon, Frank Mervan, and Tom McDermott Jr. who have officially announced. Oh, and Jim Harper. Who of those people do you see kind of being able to fit in that Washington, D.C. mode?
Well, that's a good question. I really do think that Amara's leadership, or rather legislative experience, really is important. But I do think that Tom McDermott and Frank Mervan are known for getting things done. And so I think it's too early to tell. And I think any one of them is going to be almost a shock to the system for Northwest Indiana, first congressional district voters, because we've become so accustomed to Pete Visclosky's style in that office.
You know, I know there's one other candidate. I won't mention a name because the person hasn't made it official, but supposedly they live in the Miller area and may have close ties to the mayor of Chicago, Lori Lightfoot. And I was told that her campaign is planning to use a lot of Lori Lightfoot's people to help in her candidacy. Would that play well in Northwest Indiana if they know of Chicago people helping to get the word out for a Northwest Indiana candidate?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think it's too early to tell. Because I think there are some other candidates out there, outstanding candidates out there, potential candidates, that are going to throw their name in the ring. I think it's a little too early to tell if the Chicago connection will carry weight or drag that person down.
You know, Pete Visclosky, we know he's been serving in Congress for 34 years. That's a pretty long time. And, of course, his bread and butter has always been the steel mills and the steel industry in Northwest Indiana, as well as it should. And in the environment, he's really been big on the Indiana Dunes National Park. Is the new person going to be able to get in there and fight for those issues, or do you think they're going to have different priorities?
I think we'll have to wait and see what the top issues are once they get into office, which would be 2021. Things can change. A lot of things can change in the next 13 months. Pete was there for a long time and had to build up his seniority, so to speak, but he had to build up his reputation to getting things done and bringing those projects and monies back home. Whoever gets into this office is going to have the same challenges. You got to show something at first. You'll have to bring home a couple of nice pieces of legislative action, and you've got to be able to win, I think, two re-election campaigns before you really start to make difference.
You know, and we know Amara Candelaria Reardon for a long time. She's been one of the few or only Latina in the Indiana State House. Sometimes there's been one or two or maybe three or somebody who's half. Is her ethnicity going to play a big role in her candidacy, given that Northwest Indiana is very diverse? Of course, there's a sizable and large Hispanic population, but is her ethnicity going to play a big role?
I think it's going to play a role. I don't know how big a role it's going to play. I don't know if she wants it to play a big role like that, but I think it's going to play a role positively and negatively. I think a lot of people want to see that kind of history being made here in Northwest Indiana, but I think there's still a pretty underlying element that would say, doesn't look, sound, or have a name like me. I'm not so sure.
You know, we were talking a little bit between us before we get the segment started about, you know, how Northwest Indiana, especially Lake County, is still pretty solidly Democrat. But, you know, areas of South Crown Point, St. John, they've got some Republican strongholds out there. And we were kind of debating whether we think a Republican candidate could come in and kind of, wrestle this House seat away. Do you see perhaps a viable Republican candidate coming in and making a run for it? I think there could be somebody, but what do you think?
Not just yet. I think it is possible that Jim Harper will make a lot of noise in this campaign. I think there's still some Porter County candidate left to get in this campaign. I think you have to have some consensus building. I think Amara Candelaria Reardon does consensus building well. And I think Tom McDermott is very good at drawing attention across the board, not just North Lake County, but South Lake County and Porter County. Because remember, it's not just North Lake County anymore. And I think there is a Republican presence growing in South Lake County.
Oh, of course.
Yeah. So I think the numbers bear that out. Mm-hmm. So I think whoever this is, we'll just have to be able to have a much broader reach than they've ever had before.
You know, for several election cycles now, the only Republican to really run for that seat has been Mark Leyva. Mark really hasn't been able to generate any kind of fundraising or getting – I mean, he's kind of only been a name, unfortunately. Really no credible campaign to talk of. Maybe he'll change. I don't know if he's going to run again. But you think this would be a missed opportunity if the Republican Party just – if they don't put somebody in there with – you know, who can kind of almost bankroll a congressional seat campaign themselves for them not to get in, whether it's from Lake County or Porter County?
Well, first of all, let me say I give Mark Leyva a lot of respect for just keeping at it. No matter what the odds, no matter what the result, he keeps going. And you got to give a person credit for that. Is this a missed opportunity? This, of course, would be a missed opportunity for the Republican Party if they didn't field a strong candidate. And I think that candidate will pick up support in South Lake County and, like I said, in Porter County, parts of South Lake County and Porter County. So, yeah, it would be a missed opportunity. I don't see the Republican Party just letting it slip away like that.
You know, and we still some of the names that have still been floating out there as possible runs, and if they've already made it official, you know, I apologize, but people like Reagan Hatcher out of Gary, who's a state representative who I believe is trying to run perhaps for a Senate seat coming up, a state Senate seat. You know, we know her background and her name. Her father is, of course, former Gary Mayor Richard Hatcher, big name, you know, big resources. She can make the race interesting. And still the wild card out there is Mark Lopez, who's been the longtime chief of staff for Peter Vasilkovsky, who right now is running a flower shop in Maryville, which is no small feat. I love flowers.
And a tea room.
And a tea room, a Maryville tea room. I think that's what it is. But if those two people were to decide to get in, how would that sort of shape this this race? And, you know, it is interesting to know, before you get to that answer, that Pete Vasilkovsky was the longtime chief of staff for Adam Benjamin.
Correct.
So Mark would kind of know the lay of the land. I never kind of looked at it that way, but, you know, being a chief of staff is you would know how things would work. If those two people got in there, Reagan Hatcher and Mark, how would it play out?
First of all, let me say, I think as voters, it's awesome that we have a diverse pool of candidates. We have women, we have men, we have African American, Latina now, we have Caucasian.
Yeah, we've never seen this. This is opera.
That's Michael Gonzalez with Michael Puente on a recent off-mic program. And that's it for Regionally Speaking. I'm Chris Nolte, back with you on Monday.